Welcome to Alchemical Dialogues, an Amber Light podcast. Join Dr. Henry Critella and William Kelly for part two of their discussion on sexuality, sex, and spirituality. The information provided on this website and these podcasts is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this website and in these podcasts is intended to be a substitute for medical, health, therapeutic, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed by the guests in these podcasts are not necessarily the opinions of Amber Light International and anyone associated with this organization. A quick warning, this podcast contains sensitive material that may not be suitable for some listeners and listeners with children. Discretion is advised.
Thank you, Louise. And thank you again, Bill. It's a pleasure seeing you again.
It's good to see you, Henry. Yeah.
One of these times. Yeah. I know, face to face. When we were talking earlier, I realized, since this is kind of a work in progress, that we didn't give enough information about you and your background. So I just wanted to introduce you a little bit better this time. You're licensed in New York State as a clinical social worker with an R number. It means you can bill third parties. You're a diplomat in sex therapy and certified supervisor with the American Association of Sex Educators, Counselors, and Therapists, and a clinical member of the Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers. You've served as a board member for ASECT, the board president of the Gay Alliance of the Genesee Valley, New York, and as a board member for New York State, ATSA. That's the Treatment for Sexual Abusers. You've worked in residential treatment, director of different outpatient and inpatient mental health, and also substance abuse treatment centers. And your practice includes the treatment of sexual functioning problems, addressing sexual behavior issues and sexual compulsions, supporting persons in the process of gender transition and sexual identity integration. You've been an adjunct faculty and lecturer for numerous universities on topics around human sexuality, and a consultant to many agencies and clinics over the past 30 years. For those issues. You've also addressed sexual issues with persons with chronic illness and post-surgical treatment. And I think you've also done that with people who've been in long-term care facilities as well.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember you and I talking about that. You have a Bachelor of Science degree in social work from the Rochester Institute of Technology, MSW from Virginia Commonwealth University. And in 2003-04, you completed LEAH Fellowship at the University of Rochester School of Medicine in the Department of Pediatrics. So that's about sexual assessment in kids, correct?
Well, it's leadership and education for adolescent health. But I use the year to look at psychosexual development, particularly in adolescents. Yeah.
And then you joined the Rochester Center for Sexual Wellness in 2018, which is dedicated to providing sexual medicine to persons in Western New York. And you're an all-around great guy to know and to associate with, and you still make me blush.
That's good.
I know, it's good. Yeah. Eventually, we're going to try to hone in today on how sexuality and sexual issues affect our view of spirituality, our own spirituality. But where's a good place to start?
Well, when you and I talked about this, I was thinking about using a scale developed by Dorothy Riddle, PhD, many years ago that I've used for clients, particularly clients looking at their own internalized homophobia. And I've used it, obviously, for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender folks, but also for persons who identify as straight or mostly straight. And that the messages often in early childhood, adolescence, from Jerry Springer and other kinds of talk show hosts, if your sexual interest seems different than other people, often the response is a negative one from our society. And so people often internalize almost an automatic or an automatic response, negative response to sexual interest. And I think that often blocks people from really celebrating their individual sexual interests. As we said the last podcast, or I said, is our sexual interest is as individual as our fingerprints. And that's very different than when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, which is all guys wanted a blonde with certain measurements, and that's exactly what you wanted. And all women wanted a Cary Grant or Charlton Heston or something like that. We were told that there was a certain range that we wanted. And it was, of course, it was all heterosexual interest. As we talked again last month, things have really opened up in my lifetime. So the gay liberation movement in the 70s and earlier, even earlier than that, began to say that there was people, there were people out there with sexual interests that were different than simply being heterosexual. And then the transgender movement. And now the internet, with all its many kinds of sexual interests out there, really supports that our sexual interest is so diverse. And it's not generally one thing. It's not one thing. There's many aspects to that. And one of the things that we don't talk about is positive about the internet is people often begin to understand that and find communities that are similar to them. When we were talking about how would we begin today, I was thinking, well, let me talk about Dorothy Riddle's scale for a few minutes. So what I'd like to do is take out the word homosexuality and put in another word, which is just sexuality or diverse sexuality. And just go, I'm just going to read briefly through this for a minute as people are drinking their coffee and having a moment. So Dorothy Riddle was talking about different levels of attitude and from repulsion to acceptance. And one of the things that I used to say to clients was I would give them this handout and I'd ask them over the week or 2 weeks between our appointments is to take a look at this and then to see if they could identify in others and in themselves as they were having conversations where they might be on the scale as the issue of homosexuality came up. So the first one is repulsion, which is that you hear something about sexuality and the automatic response is that it's a crime against nature, that whatever that sexual expression is, the person is crazy, sick, immoral, sinful, wicked, etc. And we are justified to do anything, hospitalization, aversive conditioning, violence against that person. And that's the most extreme. So then the second one is pity, which is also labeled as heterosexual chauvinism. And that is, if you're heterosexual, is more mature and certainly to be preferred, any possibility of becoming straight should be reinforced. And those who seem to be born that way should be pitied. And this really gets applied to people whose sexual interests frighten us. Henry mentioned that I'm a member of ATSO, which is, I spent many years of my life working with people engaged in sexual harm to others. And what we worked with was to help them understand and manage that, their sexual interest, not to change it, because in truth, we really can't do that. We can shut it down with drugs, we can make them zombies, but we really can't make them change. The third is tolerance, and this is, which is that whatever sexual expression you have is just a phase that you're going through, and most people grow out of it. Now, there is a little truth to that, which is particularly adolescent boys are what I call trisexual. They try anything, okay? And as we get older, people's sexual interest generally becomes more solidified. So that there's a truth about adolescent development that people are open, particularly boys are much more open to experimentation. Although as gender roles are changing, females are also in that age group. They're trying out things pretty much the same level as boys though. Acceptance implies there's something to accept that characterized by such statement as you're not a lesbian, you're a person, what you do is your own business. I'm sure you've heard all this. It's fine with me, just don't flaunt it. So then there's levels of support. And the first one is whatever that sexual expression is to work to safeguard people's rights of sexual expression. Now, I'm not suggesting that those rights include harming other people, but that we have a right to our individual sexual, what that is, without being condemned or being judged. People at this level may be uncomfortable themselves, but aware of the anti-sexual climate and irrational unfairness. Admiration acknowledges that being, in this case, gay or lesbian in our society takes strength. People at this level are willing to truly examine their attitudes, values, and behaviors. So admiration, as we move into this new phase of sexual expression with the internet and individual sexual interest, I think this is really important that many people who have accepted other forms of sexual expression now look at the wider range, and we're willing to examine our own attitudes, values, and behaviors. Appreciation is that there's really value in diversity, that people see that sexual expression is an important and essential part of our diversity, and that people are willing to, when there's negative comments about people's sexuality, are willing to step up and say something about that and combat themselves. And on Riddle scale, number 8 is nurturance, assumes that all sexual expression is indispensable to our society. And we view people who express different sexual interests and views with genuine affection and delight and are willing to be allies and advocates. And I would add number 9, which is really celebration, that our sexuality is an integral part of who we are, the spirit, the spark, the shadow. We embrace it, we explore it, we celebrate our individual sexual nature. So that's Riddle scale with a couple of additions. And I'm just gonna ask Louise, maybe, I know we're supposed to do 15 minutes, but just spend a minute or two getting people's reaction to this.
Not just the question, comments are invited as well.
Bill, if you took this model and you removed homosexuality and lesbianism, if you remove all that from the model and you just replace it with an assumption of sexuality, what would the implications be for communities that are scary for us to talk about, or for the people who are in the norm of society of say, heterosexuality? What would the implications be for both extremes if you took this entire model and took the assumption of homosexuality out of it?
Great question. Others have similar kinds of questions, something along those lines? Well, my belief, Paul, is homosexuality is being taken out by the internet. And so that what I observe, and of course I see this in a clinical setting, so people hopefully have some ability to share safely their sexual interest. But I'm seeing a lot of cases of people who are expressing sexual interest that has been there forever, but they're beginning to express it now. And I think so in 2020, as we move ahead, I believe that there will be a movement very similar to the LGBTQ movement back in the 70s, 80s, 90s that you and I were involved in, and that we will see people beginning to talk about their sexual interests in much more robust and individual ways. And is we're always in a culture war, at least from my experience, there will be pushback on this. So there will be pushback in much the way that Senator Rick Santorum said, if you're gay, then the next thing is that it'll be bestiality, man on dog sort of stuff. So I'm guessing as we move politically, as people move politically expressing themselves, there will be a pushback. But from a mental health point of view, I think that as people integrate those parts of themselves, that's a plus, because my belief is if those parts are split off from us, or they are parts that get ascendancy every once in a while, but not really something we can speak to or be supported in, then they can become problematic for any of us in terms of compulsive behaviors or unwanted behaviors. So I think that as there's a more liberal approach to this, it's probably a good thing.
So Bill, you said last time we talked, I believe, that for you, there are only two criteria of something that is not acceptable. One of them being coercion.
Well, actually, I said three things. Okay. Safe, sane, and consensual. Sane is relative. Sane is in the eye of the beholder. Safe means that one isn't going to be harmed, and consensual means that we're following the rule.
So we take sane and consensual. You're laughing about sane, but that's part of the issue. So in my work as a psychiatrist, when I was in medical school, homosexuality was an illness. Mm-hmm. So there was something not sane about it. So what is an example of not sane?
Well, right now, pedophilia is listed in the DSM-5 as a mental health disorder. It's a very rare disorder in the probably thousands of people I've worked with around sexual harm. I've only come across a handful of men who have met the criteria of pedophilia. And these are men that didn't ask for that. That's their sexual interest. I've also worked with a lot of men who, to our knowledge, never engaged in sexual harm of anybody. But their sexual interest is about prepubescent children. And are they mentally ill? Well, I don't know. They acknowledge that that's their interest. They don't really like having sexual relationships with adults. Most of them I knew that I worked with had jobs that they probably enriched children's lives because they were involved with children, but not in a sexual way. Does that make them mentally ill? I don't know. Those are tough questions. Most people would react with repulsion with what I just said. So that's sort of what I'm getting at, which is we react automatically rather than hearing things, which we were talking about last Thursday, about that it cuts myself off from really listening when I already have these prejudged belief systems.
So like bestiality, is that sane?
Well, it would be sane. It wouldn't be consensual because dating outside your species, you can't get consent. So that would be doing sexual harm to some animal because that animal can't get consent for that. But I am curious, as you and I are talking and Paul and I were talking, what are some of the reactions? If you took this list, repulsion, pity, tolerance, acceptance, admiration, if you were to categorize some of your feelings, what would the feeling be as we're talking about pedophilia? We're talking about bestiality. What are some of the reactions? I'm curious from people who are here on the podcast.
I see that as you went down that list, Bill, as a kind of developmental sequence.
Okay, Bob. Yeah, same one.
That I start off in one of the earlier stages, and as I develop and think and grow and mature, I move up I'll call it up. There's a value judgment, of course, right there. I move up the scale into more, one of the more positive things. What I hadn't thought of as you were describing it, though, is that that's going to depend on what the behavior is. If I've got two consenting adults who wish to engage in a same-sex relationship, no harm, I'm perfectly accepting and maybe not celebrating, but I'm okay. But when you say pedophilia and bestiality, I back up on the developmental scale. I think to myself, well, I'm not ready for that.
So can I stay with you on this for a minute?
Sure.
What does that do to one's fantasies? Because our fantasies, I don't know about you, but most of mine aren't legal. Okay. I haven't negotiated, whatever they're about, I haven't negotiated with that person or persons. Mm-hmm. So it's not consenting. It's just a fantasy. What happens using this model or something when we're in conflict with our sexual fantasies?
I guess my first reaction to that is that fantasies are entirely mine and don't have a need for any consent from anybody. It's when I begin to move from fantasy to action that I need to be concerned about, and where consent has a valid place in the discussion. But I think the reaction I have as you describe that is the problem becomes then if my fantasies are widely seen from one of the negative vantage points, then that begins to impact my vision of myself.
Absolutely.
What kind of a person am I?
What kind of a person am I?
Yes. Yeah, you know, even if they're only fantasies, what kind of person am I?
Yes.
Who, if I'm bucking the widespread negative reaction to those kinds of fantasies, what kind of a person am I to have these fantasies? What does that say about me? What value reflection does it have on me?
Absolutely.
Gets a little complicated then.
Gets complicated. I see John is...
Yeah, actually, it's funny. It's a real... I mean, I have to admit, when you spoke about pedophilia, my initial was, I was repulsed, of course. I understand. And I mean, I could speak for, you know, quite a bit. I mean, as a teacher, of course, when I hear that, a part of me is like, right? And, you know, when we talk about sexual fantasies, and this is interesting because it's sort of, you know, when I wrote back to Louisa last couple weeks ago about what I was feeling about with the podcast, I was aware that there was sort of a dichotomy in between sex and spirituality. And so, for instance, when I was thinking about, you know, we were just talking about fantasies, in our order, in the Nighty order, you know, Murshid talks about being careful about speaking, being careful about what we say and what we think. And also there's the level of what we dream and what we sort of fantasize about. And, you know, there are times I can go back over my fantasies and say, oh my God, I'm hoping that no one's really in on this, right? And then there's this whole idea of if I'm fantasizing about something, even though I might say to myself, this is within my inner sphere, some spiritualities would say, is that not also working at a different level? Is that not also sort of perpetuating certain ideas in the consciousness of humanity, which would be harmful to young children if they were acted out? See, this is the whole idea when the spirituality aspect of it really makes it sort of difficult, because my own experience as a gay person in my spirituality has been sexuality is something that we should be not repulsing, but controlling so that we can reach farther and higher. And that really works hard with me because I'm also a sexual being. So it's like every time I explore sex, am I sort of like cutting myself short from spiritual energy? But anyway, I don't want to get too many ideas going here. Other than the fact of sticking maybe perhaps with the idea of fantasy, what does it mean as a human consciousness issue, right? Is there responsibility in it?
Is it also tied with earlier beliefs that aren't necessarily true? Spiritual beliefs, religious beliefs, in my mind, are often connected with, or sometimes connected with, things that aren't true. Like, in my mind, the story of Onan in Exodus, about spilling a seed upon the ground, and that's the reason why there's a prohibition on masturbation. I don't know if you people remember the sin of Onan. But the belief was that males were sort of like a gun with bullets in it, and you only got so many bullets, and that we were sending humans into a woman's uterus, that she didn't have an egg, that she was just the vessel for that. So part of me sort of wonders at times the beliefs, because there wasn't science, you couldn't see an egg. There was no microscopes back then. So there was these beliefs about sexuality that later science has said is different. And of course, at that time, the human species needed to reproduce a great deal because of infant mortality. So part of what I also wonder is those beliefs and the beliefs that I was taught, John, which is if you have a thought, you may act on it. And that would be terrible. So that sexual thoughts and feelings and fantasies in and of themselves could be frightening. We're also talking as adults, as children, as those stage one adolescents, 9, 10, 11, 12, as the endocrine system gears up and the fantasies become much more intense, what happens to them? What happens to them about connecting with their sexual selves and their fantasies when they're getting mixed messages? I've always sort of wondered about that. That's another, you were saying there's too many things in the mix and I'm adding a whole bunch of other ones. Okay.
Paul also raises his hand and talked about, this brings up the issue of guilt and sin. And for those of you that are not, I know the spiritual path that John was talking about. So there's a belief that, and I actually share part of this belief, that there's different levels of vibration that create an atmosphere. So it isn't just action. It's also what you think, what you feel. And the Zoroastrians would say, it's right thought, right speech, right action. It's all of those. So it isn't limited to just, well, I have a fantasy, but it's all mine, and I don't act on it, and I don't harm anyone. There are mystics or spiritual people who, and religious people who would say, no, no, the thought in and of itself, like John was referring to, creates something. Uh-huh. You may not see it, but it's creating something. From a psychological point of view, the bugaboo that psychiatrists would have is, depends on your ego strength. With some people, if the fantasy is strong enough and they don't have, to get Freudian about it, a really strong conscience or superego, it manifests into action. And part, I would imagine, the assessment would be, can somebody really keep it in their fantasy? Or does the fantasy become more like an obsession that eventually gets acted out? I actually don't know the data for that. But I know that one of the concerns is the ability of somebody to hold something in fantasy. So even in a typical mental health interview, and those of you that are in mental health, comment on this, as you're exploring something in psychotherapy, one of the assessments that the therapist is making is, as material is coming out, is this person going to be able to handle that? Or are they going to literally explode in the session and get violent towards me? Are they going to, or this happens with dream work even. Some people who are somewhat fragile have dreams that are pretty bizarre. And as they, if they explore the dream, not just sexual, but it could be sexual, as they explore the dream, you can hear them and see them literally becoming psychotic, because it's too primitive material and they don't have the ego structure, if we believe in that, to hold that together. I just want to not skirt away from this, because part of the focus today is, what does all of this do to our spirituality? So if you're in a belief system that says, it's not just action, it's what you think. And what you think will have an effect in the atmosphere, even if you never act it out. That's what John was referring to. That's a really powerful statement, if you really believe that. Not to mention, as Bob was pointing out, and I think Paul in your chat, what does that do to your self-esteem about who you are and who you think you're supposed to be? I believe the path that John was talking about, and that many of us have been exposed to or are actually on, is a mystical path, which is supposed to be pretty liberal. So it's very encompassing and very inclusive. But if you look at some of the original writings, it's very pejorative. homosexuality was a no-no. Bestiality, I'm not even sure they could say the word, but there were implications about how terrible that is. And it was also very prescriptive about parenting and education. And we've grown, a lot of us feel like that is really outdated. And that was cultural. That wasn't an esoteric mystical teaching. It was filtered through somebody's culture.
Yes.
But it was presented in a way as this is a great esoteric teaching and this is the way human beings are supposed to be. And some of us have said, that's just plain wrong. And that does something to your self-esteem when you've committed yourself to this path and then you have to stand up and say, wait a minute, that can't, like you were saying, Bill, that can't be right. That just isn't the way it is. So what does that do to your whole belief system if something that was presented to you, as it was presented to me in Catholicism and in the mystical tradition I follow, as this is a core belief? Or to make it worse, this person is like a prophet. What they say cannot be wrong. And then it's like, wait a minute, it has to be wrong. What are we talking about? So I'm curious what people think about, what about this? If you have fantasies, does that vibration really go out into the atmosphere and do something? And who says it's bad? Some of us are reading Care of the Soul. He had a very provocative, interesting statement in one of the chapters we just read. And he basically said, incest. Now, to me, that's repulsive. And he said, one of the problems with incest is the culture has said, if you've been a victim of incest, you're a victim. And boy, are you going to have trouble. And you're going to have post-traumatic stress disorder. The implication is that might be more damaging than the actual incest. And I thought about this. It really hit me in part because somebody else was having a conversation with me and said, I'm doing some coaching with somebody. They realized there was a sexual inhibition in their relation, in their marital relationship. And they wondered where it was coming from. As we were exploring it, she said, oh, my father or stepfather, I can't remember which one, had sex with me when I was a teenager. And then realized, oh, in the marital relationship, there was a similar kind of reaction that happened. That cleared up the difficulty. The interesting thing to me is the person insisted to the coach, but I liked my father and stuff. It was, they taught me about sex. It was actually consensual and I liked it. And that was like, is that denial? What is that? I can't remember how old the person was, but I think she was a teenager. So she was saying, oh, my father or stepfather, he helped me. This isn't a problem. But now I understand, oh, I was having that reaction. That's the reaction I had as a teenager, and then it got fixed. But no animosity, didn't see herself as a victim, and as far as I know, in many other respects, was doing very, very well as a human being. So I had that in my memory bank. Not sure I believed it. And then I read that statement from Thomas More and was like, there's a grain of truth in there, that our belief system does more damage than the actual event. How can you say it's okay? You know?
Two more folks with questions, Darren and then Bob.
When I was looking down the list, there was a kind of despair that how far down the list we had to go before we got into really positive territory. But what you were talking about, especially in terms of fantasies, what strikes me is the impact on a person's self-acceptance. And I think we talked about that in several ways in people's recent comments. But if somebody has a fantasy that, first of all, they might not feel comfortable sharing, or second of all, that they might not even feel comfortable to recognize and acknowledge in themselves, you know, that they think, oh, this is just weird, or I'm obviously unhealthy for having this fantasy. I think working with that can provide more fruitfulness.
Yeah, I think it's not the fantasy. It's levels that one acknowledges that fantasy. I think that's what I'm hearing you say. And for many people, fantasies become compartmentalized. There was a wonderful book many years ago, Familiar Faces, Hidden Lives. And it's about gay men who we would all know as being straight or not really thinking about it, because when the book was written, everybody was heterosexual, according to the world, but were having hidden lives. And so there's an exterior, the part that we see, and I think often what I think about in terms of Jung would be one of the archetypes, the magician or the wizard, in which you see me, but you don't get to see me. So I think that's part of the developmental piece that I experienced, particularly in working with a lot of gay men over the years, which is they'll tell me everything about their credentials and who they are and what they've done, but I won't know you. So that gets back to me in terms of spirit and soul, because there is then this projection about who I am, but you don't get to know me. And the other part is that somebody pointed out, I don't want you to know me, and if you did know me, you wouldn't accept me. So I've created this persona, this archetype. They're two separate things, but so that you won't see me. And I believe that kind of splitting is another thing, but there is that split piece. And I think that also goes to sexual expression in the moment, either with yourself or with someone else, that people can be split off from themselves when there are these strong anti-sexual messages. And in some of the brief work I've done with Henry and others about the soul, realizing that not only do I, if I split off from myself, not only can I not hear others, I can't hear myself in that process. So I think it does have a profound impact on people. Thanks, Durham. Now, Louise, you said there were others?
Yes, there's something in the chat, which I'll read from Paul. The soul seems to focus on the negative impacts. Can anyone speak to the power of sexuality to access the divine?
Well, Henry, I would be interested for you to respond to Paul's question.
Sure. There's a fair amount of thought that the Abrahamic traditions, the religions, so Islam, Christianity, Judaism in particular, have really done a disservice in that they would, I'm going to exaggerate just a little bit, but not a lot, sexuality, just plain sexuality, heterosexual sexuality, would be for them, number one, repulsion. That's how bad it is. That sex was dirty. And that spirituality was only transcendent. You had to reach up to find the divine, and that is so separate from this dirty, ugly world. And that was a lot of the going thinking. That also impacted the role of women, who were seen as very tied to the earth and sexuality. And this is all from a male perspective. In general. So I think it added to the misogyny that emerged in our culture and really is still going on. So that's a real disservice. And I think one of the things that's happening in the spirituality is as we're becoming more open and celebratory of the wide range of normal sexuality, there's a change in what that means in terms of real spirituality. Real spirituality is a combination. It's a marriage, in a sense, of the transcendent, where we're focusing on a power greater than us that we are still a part of and connected to, and a more horizontal dimension where spirituality is alive right now in our sexuality, in our everyday life, and in our shadows, in our thoughts, in things that, even in our wounds, the things that we think of as negative and harmful are part of our spirituality. They make for a rich, complete life. We have a teacher who said, you know, if you wanted to just be good, however you want to define that, you should have stayed an angel. The advantage to being a human being is you're an angel and a devil. You're good and bad. And the other extremely good news is you don't have to try to be bad. It just happens. So you don't have to work at it. And that's a little tongue-in-cheek, but a real gift. So the other part that goes with that is as we become more accepting of the range of not just sexuality, what it means to be a complete human being, then all of a sudden that pressure about, oh, these terrible fantasies I have, you know, maybe rape fantasies or bestiality or whatever, oh, if I can accept that, you know, this doesn't make me bad. It's what I was born with. It's what I have. Okay, I'm going to take Bill Kelly, which I really like, the safe, sane, and consensual. So, right, I can't act it out because that's going to be harmful. But having that fantasy, is that really going to disturb the spiritual atmosphere and create dysfunction? What I'm thinking is, yes, if I don't accept it, if I don't accept it as, oh, that's me for some reason, but I'm going to use the safe, sane, and consensual, and I'm not going to act it out, but the fantasy doesn't make me bad. If I think it's bad, and I try to suppress it and repress it, guess what happens? That's the vibration that'll come out and create a disturbance. One, I may not be able to contain it because it's just going to give me more pressure. I mean, hopefully we all know that. Most of the time when we try to suppress a thought, it just gives it more power. It's the tension of having the thought and, when appropriate, not acting it out, not putting it into action, actually takes the pressure off the thought. It doesn't carry as strong a vibration. And then if you add on top of that, and it doesn't make me bad anyways, it's just the way my complex was born for some reason. And then if you're of that bent, you could say, well, I wonder if there's a psychological reason why I have that particular fantasy. I wonder if, thinking about Thomas More again and James Hillman, who we're going to read, and the storyteller Michael Reed, I wonder if it's a metaphor for something in my life. It's not that I'm literally interested in bestiality. Maybe there's a metaphor in there. Maybe there is a myth, an archetypal. You mentioned it in passing, Bill. That's an archetypal issue that's coming up in my fantasy. If I take it literally and I say bad, 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 it's just going to make it worse. And it doesn't give me an avenue of exploring what's the big existential issue that's coming up in my fantasy. What is that doing? And do I have something to add to the evolution of consciousness by working on that? Working, not necessarily getting rid of it, just understand what's the meaning behind it that's more than just literal. So when I think of the teachings that I've had as a mystic, the same ones that John is talking about, that's making a big difference to me. I haven't worked it out yet, but to me, I'm convinced you try to repress it and suppress it, you know, the inner jihad, if I can use that term. No, that just makes it worse. Acting like, oh, I'm just saintly, I don't have any bad thoughts, I don't talk angrily, that just makes it worse. Most people know that's fake. When it's real, I catch the vibe inside myself and from somebody else. That's not most of the people I run into. Most of the people, I got to admit, you get in a spiritual group and the authenticity quotient starts to go down because everybody is so busy acting a certain way and needing to be so careful about how they're talking and what they're doing. You know, my fantasies go kaflooey.
There was a piece that I wanted to talk about, the power of sexuality to access the divine. And that's my Barbara Bush. Barbara, 15 years ago, my husband, my now husband, were going to an 80th birthday party in Fort Lauderdale. And the person who was being honored was part owner in a bar called Lips that they do drag shows. And in Fort Lauderdale.
This is where he makes me blush, by the way.
Okay. So Rick said, we're going to go in drag. Now, I had never gone in drag because that part of me, just that female part of me, had just been truncated. I mean, it just had been compartmentalized because it was a way that I would really expose myself as being gay. So I had to protect it. But I said, after he ordered all of the stuff, my wig, the pearls, everything. The shoes didn't fit. I don't know how anybody can wear high heels, to tell you the truth. But I wore tennis shoes. We got to the event. It's black tie. And there's a whole bunch of drag queens in black tie. They were pretty offended. He was, by the way, Audrey Hepburn from Tiffany's, okay? Breakfast at Tiffany's. But I'm Barbara Bush. I moved in that evening, the power of sexuality to access the divine. I had just one of the most wonderful evenings of my life playing out that part of me. For me, because I'm more of a hands-on sort of person, what I realized, there are parts that have been truncated or cut off. So part of that last piece, which is to celebrate in my mind, is to explore and see the possible. And by the way, I am a great Barbara Bush. I'm also a great Tina Turner. And my favorite is Sister Discipline. So, yeah.
You see what I've had to put up with all these
days. Oh, yeah. Yeah, 40 years. Yeah.
Any last comments or thoughts from anyone?
Yeah, I have a comment. There are pictures of Bill as Sister Discipline and as Barbara Bush, which I've seen, but I've never seen a picture of you as Tina Turner. So,
well, it wasn't in blackface, so I'm not following my Prime Minister, Mr. Trudeau. But the pictures, unfortunately, I'll share that for another time.
We won't put that on screen, Jim?
No, please. No.
John Earhart?
Yeah, I look at the scale, and it's very interesting because you can look at to assess yourself, you can look at to assess others, you can put different words in other than homosexuality and have that scale. And I was also kind of looking at it, you know, is it a developmental, is it like a huge Kubler-Ross-esque kind of thing that you go through those stages? And then the other thing I'll say is that when I look at it, it makes me feel kind of guilty about myself. And I feel kind of angry at some people I've known who have been good friends, because it made me realize that they're higher up on that scale, where I thought they were more towards the lower end of the scale, the acceptance end. But as I read that, I can see that they've probably viewed me as the pity, or, you know, he's a nice guy, he works hard, he helps people, comma, but oh, the poor soul, kind of stuff like that, you know. And so it kind of makes me reevaluate some of those things and that. So, just want to make those comments about the scale. And it's interesting. It's very thought-provoking.
Thank you. And I think also for me, I can then engage those people in a different way.
Well, for me, I had I have a friend I knew for 25 years, and moving from being who I was, which was very clear for that whole time frame, moving towards a commitment and marriage essentially became the deal breaker, which makes me look at where that person must have been on those in that scale. I guess I saw the person more as maybe a 7, 8, or 9, so to speak, and the person was probably 2 or 3, you know, and that was very rattling to find that out after having such a long time in that relationship and friendship.
So I'm a straight male, and I'm good friends with John Earhart and good friends with Bill.
Yeah.
Yep. Listen, it's just in editing. You want me to have Elise take out? There were two Johns, and I didn't want to get confused. I grew up straight. I didn't know any gay people that I knew of as a kid or a young adult. And I had conservative medical training, so homosexuality was an illness. And for some reason, I think this is true, when I started to meet people who were gay, and especially if they were my friends, my head said, oh, well then the training I had was all wrong. I mean, I still remember that. It didn't overtly change the level of friendship. And it was a little bit of a surprise, but I don't remember focusing on that. I remember feeling like, well, isn't that interesting? And that taught me something. And then it just, as our relationships continued and even got deeper, it was, Kathleen and I had the privilege of marrying Bill and his husband, Rick. And we did, this was back in the day, but we were following what was called a universal worship, and John had referred to as the Unity Order. I remember telling Bill that it was the most fun and it was the most sincere, because that service actually meant more when it was the gay couple who were getting married. Because the service really focuses on inclusivity. And I could really feel it, because it was, you know, gay marriage was still relatively new, kind of. And I felt really proud that, oh, my friends are getting married and I can be part of this and share a service that actually, even though I don't think it meant it when it was originally developed, it actually was great for non-heterosexual couplings, because it's all about inclusivity. There's one thread, it's the thread of love that goes through everything. And then we can just celebrate each other. That's what I learned from my friends.
Two more folks with questions, Bob and Maria Christina.
I'm reacting to Paul's question about speaking to the power of sexuality to access the divine. And I'm thinking about two things out of my Christian faith. And one is the mystic saints who experienced ecstasy. And when you read about that, even if you don't know about sex, you will when you finish reading that. It's all very sexual.
Yeah, it is.
And the other is, one that always is a bit of a surprise to me, is St. Paul talks about marriage as being a parallel to the relationship between Christ and his church. That's the same Paul who said it's better to marry than to burn in the fires of desire. That's where he was at with that. And yet, when he describes that, he says that marriage should be the relationship between husband and wife, and I'm sure he knew that that included sex, should be the same as the relationship between Christ and his church. So they're being held up. Sexuality is being held up as a template, if you will, for what deep spiritual relationships should be like.
Right. And the wife could not be a teacher, and the wife had to be subservient, and church had to be subservient to Christ. You can get all into that kind of
right. business. But the idea that somehow or other the marriage should be that kind of a thing. It has spiritual wraps around it. And I think that gets to what Paul was asking, I think.
Maria, Christina?
Going back to that list, the issue for me would be when there is no consent. So in the case of pedophile, or where somebody else is being hurt, I'm not sure that I can even get close to acceptance. forgiveness, acceptance, I'm not sure. But it depends on what the situation is from the way that I'm looking at it. I'm not sure.
I think it's a hard one. It was a hard one for me. There's a difference for me between behavior and thought. So if we're talking about thought or fantasy,
that's a whole different
thing. That if it's engaged in behavior against children, no, I can't accept that. I can accept that people have rape fantasies. In fact, many people do. But that wouldn't be okay with me. A lot of people do violent things to other people. I can accept that. But that they would actually do that would not be okay.
So the thought would be okay. The fantasy is okay, but not the behavior.
Yeah.
Some spiritual groups would say even the fantasy would not be okay. And I think I'm going more in line with you as I think about it, that even though I really believe in vibration, I think there's a nuance to that because of the power that trying to suppress it gives. It looks like from your data, and even mentioning it in passing, it's a normal human phenomena. People have a wide range of fantasies, many of which it wouldn't be good if they were acted out, because it wouldn't fulfill that criteria of safe and consensual. The argument would be about sane. And I think as a psychiatrist, we've been over-pathologizing way too much, you know.
And it would be expensive. I'd have to get another bigger boat because they're always on boats.
That's true. And you would make me blush more and more. Well, thank you all.
Thank you, Henry. Thank everybody.
If you find yourself enjoying our podcast, please do us a favor and spread the word. Tell a friend about it. Post it on social media. If you or someone you know would like to participate in a future podcast, please connect with us through the Contact Us page. See our events calendar page for dates to our next live podcast recordings. We'd love for you to participate and ask questions. Alchemical Dialogues are live and unscripted conversations recorded on Zoom, brought to you by the great folks of Amberlight International, a nonprofit organization co-founded by Henry Curtella, MD, and Kathleen Fitzpatrick, LCSW. We choose topics from our current social and cultural climate with an emphasis on humanism and spirituality.